Warren Buffett's annual letter to shareholders recently landed right on schedule as the first post-Munger letter. This is probably an historical document. As always, Warren Buffett's insights into the economy, investments, corporate governance, the government were eagerly anticipated. I have no idea what role Charlie Munger played in the writing of this letter. Probably not much. So perhaps I'm just imagining it, but I feel that the tone and the depth of the analysis have shifted ever so subtly. The absence of Munger was palpable, yet Buffett's narrative carried the enduring legacy of their collaboration, prudent investment, intrinsic value assessment, and a steadfast commitment to shareholders, everything Munger stood for. As you know, I'm a huge fan of Charlie Munger and Warren Buffett. If you have not read Poor Charlie's Almanac, I would highly encourage you to. The book is massive and is very cool. There's a big distinction between Warren Buffett's wealth and Charlie Munger. Charlie Munger was only worth a few billion dollars, and yet he was partners with Warren Buffett, who's worth approximately $190 billion. The reason being, Charlie began giving away money much sooner than Warren did. After the eulogy at the beginning of the letter, which I'm going to be honest, brought a slight tear to my eye, Buffett gets down to talking about Berkshire's financial performance. Here's a point he addresses, which you and I should pay attention to. He writes, "Financial reporters will focus on page K72. There, they will find the proverbial bottom line, labeled net earnings. These numbers read $90 billion for 2021, $23 billion for 2022, and $96 billion for 2023. What in the hell is going on? What he is referring to, of course, is to the fact that, to simplify somewhat, U.S. accounting rules now necessitate unrealized capital gains and losses to figure in this calculation. Friends, that scares the hell out of me, that the government might start to count unrealized gains. It would completely destroy the way we invest. This sounds absurd, and it is. However, the strange thing is that psychologically, many of us do the same thing in our own personal investments. Not only that, we allow this to affect our mood and our investing behavior. When the stock market goes up, people love to borrow equity out of their house and on their stocks and spend it on the dumbest shit. They will borrow money out of their house to fix it up. They will borrow money out of their house to build a fucking swimming pool. People will do the dumbest things when money, and it's on paper, it's not even a realized gain, it will make them do the dumbest of things. While Buffett's subsequent commentary on this accounting practice sheds light on the often misunderstood and sometimes irrational world of financial reporting, it also highlights a critical lesson for individual investors: the importance of distinguishing between paper gains and losses and actual financial health. The volatility reflected, I lost my place. The volatility reflected in Berkshire Hathaway's reported earnings is a stark reminder of how market fluctuations can dramatically impact reported financials, even without any real change to a company's underlying value. Through this discussion, Buffett implicitly invites investors to adopt a more nuanced view of their own personal portfolios, urging them not to be swayed by temporary market movements, but to focus on long-term value and fundamentals. To this point, is particularly relevant at the current juncture when equity values in the stock market is on fire. For most investors, wonderful returns are guaranteed no matter what they invest in. Every investor and every fund manager has seemingly gained the Midas touch. This is dangerous. It breeds overconfidence and sets us up for future disappointment. The wisdom in Buffett's letter is timeless, echoing Buffett and Munger's long-held belief in value investing and the importance of maintaining a level head amidst market shenanigans. Buffett's ability to distill complex financial principles into straightforward, actionable advice is evident as ever even in Munger's absence. However, there's a lot more. These reflections on the fickle nature of capital, gains and losses, serves not just as an investment advice, but as a broader commentary on the nature of financial perceptions versus reality. It highlights how even seasoned investors might fall prey to the psychological traps set by unrealized gains and losses and the need for a disciplined, principled approach to investing. This section of the letter, like many before it, becomes not just a report on Berkshire's financial performance, but a master class in investment philosophy. And that's why I can encourage everyone that knows me and that is in the Money Flow Trading Society, affectionately referred to as the MFG, to read this fucking letter or stay stupid. I'm telling you, read this letter every year. Go back and read old ones when you don't have anything to read. It will help you learn how to manage a portfolio and how it really, really, really works. Indian investors need this dose of reality now, Indiana. Just the other day, market regulators in Shiba issued a statement about the fraud that is India, built up in their small cap, mid cap parks of the equity market. Their market is on fire. It's interesting that regulator is basically trying to tamper down investments. But at this point, it's probably justified. There are many winners in the Indian stock market. But there are also many fakes and wannabes, as in all markets. Just like in the American market, in the crypto market, we get lots of meme stocks that are going to run with the Bitcoins. Investors must keep investing, but they need to understand the reality, but really be really cautious, understand the difference in asset classes, the difference between a REIT, an index fund, an MLT, ETF, an ETN, and the difference between a growth stock, a small cap stock, a penny stock, and a blue chip stock. These distinctions, are of vital importance. And I hope you enjoy as I get into Warren Buffett's latest letter to the investors of Berkshire Hathaway, live from Omaha. Charlie Munger, the architect of Berkshire Hathaway. Charlie Munger died November 28th, just 33 days before his 100th birthday. Though born and raised in Omaha, he spent 80% of his life domiciled elsewhere. Consequently, it was not until 1959, when he was 35, that I first met him. In 1962, he decided that he should take up money management. 3 years later, he told me, correctly, that I had made a dumb decision in buying control of Berkshire. But he assured me, since I had already made the move, he would tell me how to correct my mistake. In what I next relate, bear in mind that Charlie and his family did not have a dime invested in the small investing partnership that I was then managing and whose money I had used for the Berkshire purchase. Moreover, neither of us expected that Charlie would ever own a share of Berkshire stock. Nevertheless, Charlie, in 1965, promptly advised me, "Warren, forget about ever buying another company like Berkshire. But now that you control Berkshire, add to it wonderful businesses purchased at fair prices and give up buying fair businesses at wonderful prices. In other words, abandon everything you learned from your hero, Ben Graham. It works, but only when practiced at a small scale." With much backsliding, I subsequently followed his instructions. Many years later, Charlie became my partner in running Berkshire and repeatedly jerked me back to sanity when my old habits surfaced. Until his death, he continued in his role, and together we, along with those who early on invested with us, ended up far better off than Charlie and I ever dreamed possible. In reality, Charlie was the architect of the present Berkshire, and I acted as the general contractor to carry out the day-to-day construction of his vision. Charlie never sought to take credit for his role as creator, but instead let me take the bows and receive the accolades. In a way, his relationship with me was part older brother, part loving father. Even when he knew he was right, he gave me the reins. And when I blundered, he never, never reminded me of my mistake. In the physical world, great buildings are linked to their architect, while those who had poured the concrete or installed the windows are soon forgotten. Berkshire has become a great company, And though I have long been in charge of the construction crew, Charlie should forever be created with being its architect. To the shareholders of Berkshire Hathaway Incorporated, Berkshire has more than 3 million shareholder accounts. I am charged with writing a letter every year that will be useful to this diverse and ever-changing group of owners, many of whom wish to learn more about their investment. Charlie Munger, for decades my partner in managing Berkshire, viewed this obligation identically and would expect me to communicate with you this year in the regular manner. He and I were of one mind regarding our responsibilities to the Berkshire shareholders. Writers find it useful to picture the reader they seek, and often they are hoping to attract a mass audience. At Berkshire, we have more limited target investors who trust Berkshire with their savings without any expectation of resale. Resembling an attitude, people who save in order to buy a farm or a rental property rather than people who prefer their excess funds to purchase lottery tickets or hot stocks. Over the years, Berkshire has attracted an unusual number of such lifetime shareholders and their heirs. We cherish their presence and believe they are entitled to hear every year both the good and the bad news, delivered directly from their CEO and not from an investor relations officer or communication consultant forever serving up optimism with syrupy mush. In visualizing the owners of Berkshire Seeks, I am lucky to have the perfect mental model, my sister, Berta. Let me introduce you to her. For openers, Berta is smart, wise, and likes to challenge my thinking. We have never, however, had a shouting match or anything close to a ruptured relationship. We never will. Furthermore, Bertie and her three daughters as well have a large portion of their savings in Berkshire shares. Their ownership spans decades, and every year, Berta will read what I have to say. My job is to anticipate her questions and give her honest answers. Berta, like most of you, understands many accounting terms, but she is not ready for a CPA exam. She follows business news, reading 4 or 5 newspapers daily, but doesn't consider herself an economic expert. She is sensible, actually very sensible, instinctively knowing that pundits should always be ignored. After all, if she could reliably pick tomorrow's winners, would she freely share her valuable insights and thereby increase competitive buying? That would be like finding gold and then handing a map to the neighbors, showing them its location. Berta understands the power, for good or bad, of incentives, the weakness of humans, and tells that can be recognized when observing human behavior. She knows who is selling and who can be trusted. In short, she's nobody's fool. So what would interest Berta this year? Operating results, fact, and fiction. Let's begin with the numbers. The official annual report begins on K-1 and extends for 124 pages. It is filled with a vast amount of information, some important and some trivial. Among its disclosures, many owners, along with financial reporters, will focus on page K-72. There, they will find the proverbial bottom line labeled net earnings. The numbers read $90 billion for 2021, $23 billion for 2022, and $96 billion for 2023. What in the world is going on? You seek guidance and are told that the procedures for calculating these, quote, earnings, unquote, are promulgated by a sober and presidential Financial Accounting Standards Board, or FASB, mandated by a dedicated, hardworking Securities and Exchange Commission, the SEC, and are audited by a world-class professionals at Dalty & Touch, D&T Accounting. On page K-67, D&T pulls no punches, and in our opinion, the financial statements present fairly in all material respects the financial position of the company and the results of its operations for each of the 3 years in the period ended December 31st, 2023. So sanctified, this worse than useless net income figure quickly gets transmitted throughout the world via the internet and media. All parties believe they have done their job, and legally they have. We, however, are left uncomfortable. At Berkshire, our view is this. Earnings should be a sensible concept that Bertie will find somewhat useful, but only as a starting point in evaluating a business. Accordingly, Berkshire also reports to Bertie and you what we call operating earnings. And here is the story they tell. $27.6 billion for 2021, $30.9 billion for 2022, and $37.4 billion for 2023. The primary difference between the mandated figures and the one Berkshire prefers is that we exclude unrealized capital gains or losses that at times can exceed $5 billion a day. Ironically, our preference was pretty much the rule until 2018, when the improvement, quote unquote, was mandated, and Galileo's experience several centuries ago should have taught us not to mess with mandates from on high. But at Berkshire, we can be stubborn. Make no mistake about the significance of capital gains. I expect them to be a very important component of Berkshire's value estimation during the decades ahead. Why else would we commit huge dollar amounts of your money and Bertie's to marketable equities, just as I have been doing with my own funds throughout my investing life? I can't remember a period since March 11th, 1942, the date of my first stock purchase, that I have not had a majority of my net worth in equities, U.S.-based equities. And so far, so good. The Dow Jones Industrial Average fell by 100 points on that fateful day in 1942. And when I pulled the trigger, I was down $5 by the time I got out of school. Soon, things turned around. And now, that index hovers around 38,000. America has been a terrific country for investors. All they needed to do is sit quietly and listen to no one. It is more than silly, however, to make judgments about Berkshire's investments values based on earnings that incorporate the suspicious day-by-day and, yes, even year-by-year movements of the stock market. As Ben Graham taught me, in the short run, the market acts as a voting machine. In the long run, it becomes a waiting machine. Our goal at Berkshire is simple. We want to own either all or a portion of businesses that enjoy good economics that are fundamental and enduring. Within capitalism, some businesses will flourish for a very long time while others will prove to be sinkholes. It's harder than you would think to predict which will be winners and losers. And those who tell you they know the answer are usually either self-delusional or snake oil salesmen. At Berkshire, we particularly favor the rare enterprise that can deploy additional capital at high returns in the future. Owning only one of these companies and simply sitting tight can deliver wealth almost beyond measure. Even heirs to such holdings can sometimes live a lifetime of leisure. We also hope these favored businesses are run by able and trustworthy managers, although that is more difficult judgment to make. However, and Berkshire has had its share of disappointments. In 1863, Hugh McAuliffe, the first comptroller of the United States, sent a letter to all the national banks. His instructions included this warning: never deal with a rascal under the expectation that you can prevent him from cheating you. Many bankers who thought they could manage the rascal problem have learned the wisdom of Mr. McCullough's advice, and I have also. People are not that easy to read. Sincerity and empathy can be easily faked. That is true now as it was in 1863. This combination of two necessities I've described for acquiring businesses has for long been our goal in purchasing, and for a while, we had an abundance of candidates to evaluate. If I missed one, I missed plenty. Another always came along. Those days are long behind us. Size did us in, though increased competition for purchases was also a factor. Berkshire now has by far the largest GAAP net worth recorded by any American business. Record operating income and a strong stock market led to a year-end figure of $561 billion. The total GAAP net worth for the other 499 S&P companies and who's who of American business was $8.9 trillion in 2022. The 2023 number for the S&P has not yet been tallied, but it's unlikely to materially exceed $9.5 trillion. By this measure, Berkshire now occupies nearly 6% of the universe in which it operates. Doubling our huge base is simply not possible within, say, five-year period, particularly because we are highly averse to issuing shares, an act that immediately juices net worth. There remain only a handful of companies in this country capable of truly moving the needle at Berkshire, and they have been endlessly picked over by us and others. Some we can value and some we can't. And if we can, they have to be attractively priced. Outside of the U.S., there are essentially no candidates that are meaningful operations for capital deployment at Berkshire. All in all, we have no possibility of eye-popping performance. Nevertheless, managing Berkshire is mostly fun and always interesting. On the positive side, after 59 years of assemblage, the company now owns either a portion or 100% of various businesses that on a weighted basis have somewhat better prospects than exist at most large American companies. By both luck and pluck, a few huge winners have emerged from a great many dozens of decisions, and we now have small cadre of longtime managers who never muss about going elsewhere and who regard 65 as just another birthday. Berkshire benefits from an unusual consistency and clarity of purpose. While we emphasize treating our employees, communities, and suppliers well, who wouldn't wish to do so? Our allegiance will always be to our country and our shareholders. We never forget that. Though your money is co-mingled with ours, it does not belong to us. With that focus and with the present mix of businesses, Berkshire should do a bit better than the average American corporation and, more important, should also operate with materially less risk of permanent loss of capital. Anything beyond slightly better, though, is wishful thinking. This modest aspiration wasn't the case when Birdie went all in on Berkshire stock, but it is now. Our not-so-secret weapon. Occasionally, markets and or the economy will cause stocks and bonds of some large and fundamentally good businesses to be strikingly mispriced. Indeed, markets can and will unpredictably seize up or even vanish as they did for 4 months in 1914 and for a few days in 2001. If you believe that American investors are now more stable than in the past, think back to September 2008. The speed of communication and the wonders of technology facilitate instant worldwide paralysis. And we have come a long way since smoke signals. Such instant panics won't happen often, but they will happen. Berkshire's ability to immediately respond to market seizures with both huge sums and certainty of performance may offer us occasional large-scale opportunities. Though the stock market is massively larger than it was in our early years, today's active participants are neither more emotionally stable nor better taught than they were when I was in school. For whatever reason, markets now exhibit far more casino-like behavior than they did when I was young. The casino now resides in many homes and daily tempts the occupants. One fact of financial life should never be forgotten. Wall Street, to use the term in its figurative sense, would like its customers to make money, but what it truly causes its dissonance juices to flow is feverish activity. At such times, whatever foolishness can be marketed will be vigorously marketed, not by everyone, but by someone. Occasionally, the scheme turns ugly. The politicians then become enraged, and the most flagrant predators of this misdeed slip away rich and unpunished, and your friend next door becomes bewildered, poor, and sometimes vengeful. Money, he learns, has trumped morality. One investment rule at Berkshire has not and will not ever change. Never risk permanent loss of capital. Thanks to the American tailwind and the power of compound interest, the arena in which we operate has been and will be rewarding if you make a couple good decisions during a lifetime and avoid serious mistakes. I believe Berkshire can handle financial disasters of a magnitude beyond any heretofore experience. This ability is one we will not relinquish. When economic upsets occur, as they will, Berkshire's goal will be to function as an asset to the country, just as it was in a very minor way in 2008 to 2009, and to help extinguish the financial fire rather than be among the many companies that inadvertently or otherwise ignited the conflagration. Our goal is realistic. Berkshire's strength comes from its Niagara of diverse earnings delivered after interest, costs, taxes, substantial charges for depreciating, amortization. EBITDA is a band measurement at Berkshire. We also operate with minimal requirements for cash, even if the country encounters a prolonged period of economic weakness, fear, and near paralysis. Berkshire does not currently pay dividends, and its share repurchases are 100% discretionary. Annual debt maturities are never material. Your company also holds cash and U.S. Treasury bills, positions far in excess of what conventional wisdom deems necessary. During the 2008 panic, Berkshire generated cash from operations and did not rely in any manner on commercial paper, bank lines, or debt markets. We did not predict the time of an economic paralysis, but we were always prepared for one. Extreme fiscal conservatism is a corporate pledge we make to those who joined us in ownership at Berkshire. In most years, indeed in most decades, our caution will likely prove to be unneeded behavior. Akin to an insurance policy on a fortress-like building thought to be fireproof, but Berkshire does not want to inflict permanent financial damage. Quotationable shrinkage for extended periods cannot be avoided on Bertie or any other individuals who have trusted us with their savings. Berkshire is built to last. Non-controlled businesses that leave us comfortable. Last year, I mentioned two of Berkshire's long-duration partial ownership positions, Coca-Cola and American Express. These are not huge commitments like our Apple position. Each only accounts for 4 to 5% of Berkshire's GAAP net worth, but they are meaningful assets and also illustrate our thought process. American Express began operations in 1850. Coca-Cola was launched in Atlanta drugstore in 1886. Berkshire is not big on newcomers. Both companies tried expanding into unrelated areas over the years and both found little success in these attempts. In the past, but definitely not now, both were even mismanaged. But each was hugely successful in its base business, reshaped here and there as conditions called for. And crucially, their products traveled. Both Coke and American Express became recognizable names worldwide, as did their core products. And the consumption of liquids and the need for unquestionable financial trust are timeless and essential of products of our world. During 2023, we did not buy or sell a share of either American Express or Coke, extending our own Rip Van Winkle slumber that has now lasted well over two decades. Both companies, again, rewarded our inaction last year by increasing their earnings and dividends. Indeed, our shares, American Express earnings in 2023, considerably exceeded $1.3 billion cost of our long ago, exceeded the $1.3 billion cost of our long ago purchase. Both American Express and Coke will almost certainly increase their dividends in 2024, about 16% in the case of American Express, and we will most certainly leave our holdings untouched throughout the year. Could I create a better worldwide business than these two enjoy? As Bertie will tell you, no way. Though Berkshire did not purchase shares of either company in 2023, your indirect ownership of both Coke and American Express increased a bit last year because of share repurchases we made at Berkshire. Such repurchases work to increase your participation in every asset that Berkshire owns. To this obvious but often overlooked truth, I add my usual caveat. All stock repurchases should be price dependent. What is essential at a discount to a business value becomes stupid if done at a premium. The lesson from Coke and American Express: when you find a truly wonderful business, stick with it. Patience pays. And no one wonderful business can offset And one wonderful business can offset many mediocre decisions that are inevitable. This year, I would like to describe two other investments that we expect to maintain indefinitely. Like Coke and American Express, these commitments are not huge relative to our resources. They are worthwhile, however, and we were able to increase both positions in 2023. At year-end, Berkshire owned 27.8% of Occidental Petroleum common shares and also own warrants that for more than 5 years give us the option to materially increase our ownership at a fixed price, though we very much like our ownership as well as the option. Berkshire has no interest in purchasing or managing Occidental. We particularly like its vast oil and gas holdings in the United States, as well as its leadership in carbon capture initiatives, though the economic feasibility of this technique has yet to be proven. Both of these activities are very much in our country's interest. Not so long ago, the U.S. was woefully dependent on foreign oil, and carbon capture had no meaningful constituency. Indeed, in 1975, the U.S. production was 8 million barrels of oil equivalent per day, a level far short of the country's needs. From the favorable energy position that facilitated the U.S. mobilization in World War II, the country had retreated to become heavily dependent on foreign oil, potentially unstable suppliers. Further declines in oil production were predicted, along with future increases in usage. For a long time, the pessimism appeared to be correct, with production falling to 5 million barrels per day by 2007. Meanwhile, the U.S. government created a strategic petroleum reserve, and in 1975 to alleviate, though not come close to eliminating, this erosion of American self-sufficiency. And then, hallelujah, shale economics became feasible in 2011, and our energy dependence ended. Now the U.S. production is more than 13 million barrels of oil per day, and OPEC no longer has the upper hand. Occidental itself has an annual U.S. oil production that year that each year comes to matching the entire inventory of the SPR. Our country would be very, very nervous today if domestic production had remained at a 5 million barrels and if it found itself largely dependent on non-U.S. sources. At that level, SPR would have been empty within months if foreign oil became unavailable. Under Vicki Hollop's leadership, Occidental is doing the right things for both its country and its owners. No one knows what oil prices will do over the next month, year, or decade, but Vicki does know how to separate oil from a rock. And that's an uncommon talent, valuable to her shareholders and to the country. Additionally, Berkshire continues to hold its passive and long-term interest in five very large Japanese companies, each of which operates in highly diversified manner, somewhat similar to the way Berkshire itself runs. We increased our holdings in all five last year after Greg Abel and I made a trip to Tokyo to talk to their management. Berkshire now owns 9% of each of the five. A minor point, Japanese companies calculate outstanding shares in a manner different from the practice in the U.S. Berkshire also pledged to each company that it will not purchase shares that will take our holdings beyond 9.9%. Our cost for the five totals is $1.6 trillion, and euro market value of five was $2.9 trillion. However, the yen has weakened in recent years, and our year-end unrealized gain in the dollar was 61% of people. And major currencies. We also don't believe we can hire anyone with this ability. Therefore, Berkshire has financed most of its Japanese positions with the proceeds from a $1 trillion of bonds. This debt has been very well received in Japan, and I believe Berkshire has more yen-denominated debt outstanding than any other American company. The weakened yen has produced a year-end gain for Berkshire of $1.9 billion. A sum that, pursuant to the GAAP rules, has periodically been recognized in income over the 2020 to 2023 period. In certain important ways, all five companies Mitsubishi and these five Japanese companies follow shareholder-friendly policies that are much superior to those customarily practiced in the U.S. Since we began our Japanese purchases, each of the five has reduced the number of outstanding shares at attractive prices. Meanwhile, the management of all five companies has been far less aggressive about their own compensation than typical in the U.S. Note as well that each of the five is applying only about one-third of its earnings dividends. The large sum the five retain are used both to build their many businesses and to a lesser degree to repurchase shares. Like Berkshire, the five companies are reluctant to issue shares. In addition, a benefit to Berkshire is the possibility that our investment may lead to opportunities for us to partner around the world with the five large, well-managed, and well-respected companies. Their interests are far more broad than ours. And on their side, the Japanese CEO have the comfort of knowing that Berkshire will always possess large liquid resources that can be instantly available for such partnerships, whatever their size may be. Our Japanese purchases began on July 4th, 2019. Given Berkshire present size, building positions through open market purchases takes a lot of patience and an extended period of friendly prices. The process is like turning a battleship. That is an important disadvantage which we did not face in our early days at Berkshire. The scorecard in 2023. Every quarter, we issue a press release that reports our summarized operating earnings or losses in a manner similar to what is shown below. Here is the full year compilation. Insurance underwriting, $5,428,000,000. Insurance investment income, $9,567,000,000. Railroad, $5,087,000,000. Utilities and energy, $2,331,000,000. Other businesses and miscellaneous items, $14,937,000,000. Operating earnings total, $37,350,000,000. At Berkshire's annual gathering on May 6, 2023, I presented the first quarter results, which had been released earlier that morning. I followed with a short summary of the outlook for the full year. Most of our non-insurance businesses face lower earnings in 2023. That decline would be cushioned by decent results at our two largest non-insurance businesses, BNSF and Berkshire Hathaway Energy, BHE, which combined had accounted for more than 30% of operating earnings in 2022. Our investment income was certain to materially grow because the huge U.S. Treasury bill position held by Berkshire had finally begun to pay us far more than the pittance we had been receiving. And insurance would likely do well, both because the underwriting earnings are not correlated to the earnings elsewhere in the economy. And beyond that, property casualty insurance prices had strengthened. Insurance came through as expected. I erred, however, in my expectation for both BNSF and BHE. Let's take a look at each. Rail is essential to America's economic future. It is clearly the most efficient way, measured by cost, fuel usage, and carbon intensity, of moving heavy materials to distant destinations. Trucking wins for short hauls, but many goods that Americans need most travel to customers many hundreds or even thousands of miles away. The country can't run without rail, and the industry's capital needs will always be huge. Indeed, compared to most American businesses, railroads eat capital. BNSF is the largest of the six major rail systems that blanket North America. Our railroad carries it 23,759 miles of main track, 99 tunnels, 13,494 bridges, 7,521 locomotives, and an assortment of other fixed assets at $70 billion on its balance sheet. But my guess is that it would cost at least $500 billion to replicate those assets and decades to complete the job. BNSF must annually spend more than its depreciation charge to simply maintain its present level of business. This reality is bad for owners, whatever the industry in which they have invested, but it is particularly disadvantaged in capital-intensive industries. At BNSF, the outlay in excess of gap depreciation charges since our purchase 14 years ago have totaled a staggering $22 billion, or more than $1.5 billion annually. Ouch. That sort of gap means BNSF dividends paid to Berkshire and its owners will regularly fall considerably short of BNSF's reported earnings unless we regularly increase the railroad's debt, and that we do not intend to do. Consequently, Berkshire is receiving an acceptable return on its purchase price, though less than it might appear. And also pittance on the replacement value of the property. That's no surprise to me or Berkshire's board of directors. It explains why we could buy BNSF in 2010 at a small fraction of its replacement value. North America's rail system moves huge quantities of coal, grain, autos, imported and exported goods. One way for long distances, and those trips often create revenue problems for backhauls. Weather conditions are extreme and frequently hamper or even stymie the utilization of the track, bridges, and equipment. Flooding can be a nightmare. None of this is a surprise. While I sit in an always comfortable office, railroading is an outdoor activity. Many employees working under trying and sometimes dangerous conditions. An evolving problem is that growing percentage of Americans are not looking for a difficult and often lonely employment conditions inherent in some of the railroad operations. Engineers must deal with the fact that among an American population of 335 million, some forlorn or mentally disturbed Americans are going to elect suicide by laying in front of a 100-car, extraordinarily heavily trained that can't be stopped in less than a mile or more. Would you like to be that helpless engineer? This trauma happens about once a day in North America, and it is far more common in Europe and will always be with us. Wage negotiations in the rail industry can end up in the hands of the president and Congress. Additionally, American railroads are required to carry many dangerous products every day that the industry would rather avoid. The words common carrier define railroad responsibilities. Last year, BNSF's earnings declined by more than I expected as revenues fell. Though fuel costs also fell, wages increased, promulgated in Washington were far beyond the country's inflation goals. This differential may reoccur in the future negotiations. Though BNSF carries more freight and spends more on capital expenditures than any of the other five major North American railroads, its profit margins have slipped relative to all five since our purchase. I believe that our vast service territory is second to none, and that therefore our margin comparisons can and should be improved. I am particularly proud of both BNSF's contribution to the country and to the people who work in sub-zero outdoor jobs in North Dakota and Montana winters to keep America's commercial arteries open. Railroads don't get much attention when they are working, but where they unavailable, the void would be noticed immediately throughout America. A century from now, BNSF will continue to be a major asset of the country and of Berkshire. You can count on that. Our second and even more severe earnings disappointment last year occurred in BHE, Berkshire Hathaway Energy. Most of its large electric utility businesses, as well as its extensive gas pipelines, performed as expected. But the regulatory climate in a few states has raised the specter of zero profitability or even bankruptcy, an actual outcome at California's largest utility and a current threat in Hawaii. In such jurisdictions, it is difficult to project both earnings and asset values in what was once regarded as among the most stable industry in America. For more than a century, electric utilities raised huge sums to finance their growth through a state-by-state promise of a fixed return on equity, sometimes with a small bonus for superior performance. With this approach, massive investments were made for capacity that would likely be required a few years down the road. That forward-looking regulation reflected the reality that utilities build generating and transmission of assets that often take many years to construct. BHE's extensive multi-state transmission project in the West was initiated in 2006 and remains some years from completion. Eventually, it will serve 10 states, comprising 30% of the acreage in the continental United States. With this model employed by both private and public power systems, the light stayed on even if population growth or industrial demand exceed expectations. The margin of safety approach seems sensible to regulators, investors, and to the public. Now, the fixed but satisfactory return pact has been broken in a few states, and investors are becoming apprehensive that such raptures may spread. Climate change adds to their worries. Underground transmission may be required, but who, a few decades ago, wanted to pay the staggering cost for such construction? At Berkshire, we have made the best estimate for the amount of losses that have occurred. These costs arose from forest fires, whose frequency and intensity have increased and will likely to continue to increase if constructive storms become more frequent. Other, it will be many years until we know the final total from BHE's forest fire loss and can intelligently make decisions about the durability of the future investments in the vulnerable western states. It remains to be seen whether regulatory environment will change elsewhere. Other electric utilities may face survival problems resembling those of the Pacific Gas and Electric and Hawaiian Electric. A confiscatory resolution of our present problems would obviously be negative for BAG. But both that company and Berkshire itself are structured to survive negative surprises. We regularly get those in our insurance business, where our basic product is risk assumption, and they will occur elsewhere. Berkshire can sustain financial surprises, but we will not knowingly throw good money after bad. Whatever the case at Berkshire, the final result for the utility industry may be ominous. Certain utilities might no longer attract the savings of American citizens and will be forced to adopt the public power model. Nebraska made this choice in the 1930s, and there are many public power operations throughout the country. Eventually, voters, taxpayers, and users will decide which model they prefer. When the dust settles, America's power needs and constant capital expenditure will be staggering. I do not anticipate or even consider the adverse developments in regulatory returns. And along with Berkshire's two partners at BHE, I made a costly mistake in not doing so. Let me repeat that. When the dust settles, America's power needs and the constant capital expenditure will be staggering. I did not anticipate or even consider the adverse developments in regulatory returns, and along with Berkshire's two partners, BHE, I made costly mistakes in not doing so. Enough about problems. Our insurance business performed exceptionally well last year, setting records in sales, float, underwriting profits. Property Casualty Insurance, PC, provides the core of Berkshire's well-being and growth. We have been in business for 57 years, and despite our nearly 5,000-fold increase in volume from $17 million to $83 billion, we have much room to grow. Beyond that, we have learned, too often painfully, a good deal about what types of insurance business and what sort of people to avoid. The most important lesson is that our underwriters can be thin, fat, male, female, young or old, foreign or domestic, but they can't be optimists at the office, however desirable that quality may generally be in life. Surprises in the property casualty business, which can occur decades after 6 month or 1 year policies have expired, are most always negative. The industry's accounting is designed to recognize this reality, but estimation mistakes can be huge. And when charlatans are involved, detection is often both slow and costly. Berkshire will always attempt to be accurate in its estimates of future loss payments, but inflation, both monetary and the legal variety, is a wild card. I've told you the story of our insurance operations so many times that I will simply direct newcomers to page 18. Here, I will only repeat that our position would not be what it is if IG Jane had not joined Berkshire in 1986. Before that lucky day, aside from an almost unbelievably wonderful experience at Geico that had begun in early 1951 and will never end, I was largely wandering in the wilderness as I struggled to build an insurance operation. At Chase, achievements since joining Berkshire have been supported by a large cast of highly talented insurance executives in our various property casualty operations. Their names and faces are unknown to most of the press and the public. Berkshire's lineup of managers, however, is to property casualty insurance what Cooperstown honorees are to baseball. What is it with Omaha? Come to Berkshire Annual Gathering on May 4th, 2024. On stage, you will see three managers who now bear the prime responsibilities for steering our company. What you may wonder, do the three have in common? They certainly don't look alike. Let's dig deeper. Greg Abel, who runs all non-insurance operations Berkshire, and in all respects is ready to be the CEO of Berkshire tomorrow, was born and raised in Canada, still plays hockey, by the way. And in 1990s, however, Greg lived for 6 years in Omaha, just a few blocks away from me. During that period, I never met him. A decade or so earlier, Ajay Jain, who was born and raised and educated in India, lived with his family in Omaha, only a mile or so from my home, where I live since 1958. Both Ajay and his wife, Taniku, have many Omaha friends, though it's been more than three decades since they moved to New York in order to be where much of the action of the reinsurance takes place. Missing from the stage this year will be Charlie. He and I were both born in Omaha, about 2 miles from where you will sit at our May get-together. In his first 10 years, Charlie lived about half a mile from where Berkshire has long maintained its office. Both Charlie and I spent our early years in Omaha public schools and were indelibly shaped by our Omaha childhood. We didn't meet, however, until much later. Footnote that may surprise you, Charlie lived under 15 of America's 45 presidents. People refer to President Biden as number 46, but that number counts Grover Cleveland as both 22 and 24. Because his terms were not consecutive, America's very young country. Moving to the corporate level, Berkshire has itself relocated in 1970 from its 71 years of residence in New England to settle in Omaha, leaving its troubles behind and blossoming into its new home. As final punctuation, point to the Omaha effect, Birdie. Yes, that's Birdie. Spent her early formative years in a middle-class neighborhood in Omaha and many decades later emerged as one of the country's great investors. You may be thinking that she put all her money into Berkshire and then simply sat on it, but that's not true. After starting a family in 1956, my sister Birdie was active financially for 20 years, holding bonds, putting one-third of her funds in publicly held mutual funds, and trading stocks with some frequency. Her potential remained unnoticed. And then in 1980, when 46, an independent of any urgings from her brother, Birdie decided to make her move, retaining only the mutual fund and Berkshire. She made no more new trades during the next 43 years. During that period, she became very rich, even after making large philanthropic gifts, thanks to nine figures. Millions of American investors could have followed her reasoning, which involved only the common sense she had somehow absorbed as a child in Omaha. And taking no chances, Birdie returns to Omaha every May to be re-energized. So what is going on? Is it Omaha water? Is it Omaha air? Is it some strange planetary phenomenon akin to that which has produced Jamaica's sprinters, Kenya's marathon runners, or Russia's chess experts? We must wait until AI someday yields the answer to the puzzle. Keep an open eye. Come to Omaha in May. Inhale the air, drink the water, and say hi to Birdie and her good-looking daughters. Who knows? There is no downside, and in any event, you will have a good time and meet a huge crowd of friendly people. To top things off, we will have the available the new fourth edition of Poor Charlie's Almanac. Pick up a copy. Charlie's wisdom will improve your life as it has mine. February 24th, 2024, Warren E. Buffett, Chairman of the Board. All right, wow, that was great, man. That's about third or fourth time I went through that letter. Hey, I hope that helps. I know a lot of you, you're driving, you're busy, you're at work, and taking in through audio can be easier for you. I hope I read it. I don't feel like I had too many mistakes there. A couple times I got choked up or lost my place or had to cough. But other than that, I thought it went pretty well. Hey, let me know what you think. If you appreciate that or if I'm, I guess if nobody listens, I'll know I don't need to do it. But feedback is always welcome, man. Hit me up. Hey, and listen, if you don't have my free ebook, you don't have to die broke. Come on, man. You already know what to do. Go to geraldpeters.info, GERALDPETERS.info. And as always, you can see what we got going on in the stock market, man. If you go to thepetersreport.com, get on our email list, get on our daily email drops where we're telling stories, putting out trades. It's the best newsletter and resource for stock traders, crypto traders in America, man. Come on, man. Get on it. Let's go.